and Tourism Committee, and would like to welcome Representative Higgum, Representative Herron, and for the record, I'm Shelley Hughes. And thank you to Debbie and Lori for being here, and Ginger for assisting us. And I believe our guest speaker, who we would have loved to have here in person, but I know he's pretty far away in the National Capital of Canada in Ottawa, Ontario. I believe that's where you are. John Higginbotham. He is the head of the Arctic Program at the Center of International Governance Innovation, Carleton University, there in Ottawa, Ontario. And he is going to be talking about North America and the new Arctic. We particularly want to learn what we can about the northern shipping route, and so that as legislators we can be thinking about Alaska's role as we move into that new frontier. And so, John, welcome. If you could identify yourself, give your name and your affiliation, and we, if you could keep your presentation to about 25 to 30 minutes, and if it's all right with you, we would also like to be able to ask questions as we move through. So go ahead and identify yourself and begin.
Good. I'm John Higginbotham. I'm a senior fellow at Carleton University and at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, Ontario. I've been in the Canadian Public Service for about 35 years, but for the last couple of years, since leaving government, I've done a great deal of work in respect of the Arctic, and particularly the North American Arctic. And I must say it's a pleasure to be invited to share some views with you, though I'm a bit intimidated by your own expertise and Bob's expertise and all the other people in Alaska, professors, senators, and so forth, where I've drawn ideas over the last couple of years.
All right, thank you, John. You go ahead and begin, and we have your PowerPoint up, and Ginger will be moving the slides forward for you.
Okay, what I'll do is go fairly quickly through my slides, because I'm pretty confident that the questions you ask will be probably the most interesting part of my presentation, as a good deal of the material will be quite familiar to you. But what I can draw bring to this particular issue, I would say, is a sense of urgency drawn out of 30 years of diplomatic practice in terms of being in Washington and Beijing and Hong Kong, and 5 years of practice in relation to a large infrastructure project that I coordinated here in Canada. And it's the gap between the urgency of the situation in respect of international pressures and the urgency of the question about applying real federal and regional resources to the future of the Arctic that makes me most interested in this. So, Ginger, could I have the first slide?
Yes, and John, I'm just going to interrupt for a minute, and for the record, Representative Tarr has joined us. Thank you. Go ahead, John.
Okay, obviously what drew me and many others to this issue is the dramatic melting of the Arctic ice cap that's taken place consistently over the past 30 years. This is a very, it's not a well understood physical phenomenon, but everyone knows that the ice is melting in the Arctic. It's having a dramatic effect on the ice, on permafrost, on communities, but also in respect of economic activity and geopolitical issues in the Arctic. The Arctic is melting two or three times faster than any other part of the planet. I won't go into the causes of global warming, which remain controversial, but we can say for sure that there has been a dramatic trend of warming in the past 20 to 30 years. And what we need to think about is where we will be 20 or 30 years from now. That's what this first slide, the big melt, suggests. It suggests what the summer ice cap would look like in various years over the next 10, 20, 40, 50 years. This is really quite an exceptionally important phenomenon for Canada and Alaska in respect of the accessibility that this will give to communities, to fishermen, to tourists, the greater ease in mineral and petrochemical exploration, certainly more and easier destinational shipping going to different small and large ports and projects in the Arctic, particularly in the Canadian archipelago, and also the possibility of transpolar shipping, because there would be a dramatic influence on world shipping movements because of the fact that you would save thousands of kilometers between Asia and Western Europe, or Asia and the Eastern United States, by going through, for example, on the Canadian side, the Northwest Passage. Could I have the next slide, please?
I have a question real quick.
Yes, we have a question, Representative Higgins.
Thank you for your time and being on the phone. Looking at your map here on the Big Melt, so I understand this correctly, 1970, that blue marker, that's where it was in 1970, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then in 2007, is that where it shrunk down to that, where we're at that level right now?
No, well, that's in the summer. That's in the maximum open period. I won't testify to the exact nature of this particular slide. It's not mine, but it does give a general impression of what the trend would look like over the next few decades.
So and then a follow-up.
Obviously, it's all frozen in the middle of winter in January and February, but the season is extending each year.
Okay, and that was my follow-up was the Northwest Passage. That's not open year-round, right? Or is it?
Oh no, it certainly is not. No, it's at the moment open. I'll get to this later, but at the moment it's only open for a couple of months a year, with some extension of that through the use of icebreakers.
Okay, thank you.
So it's not yet open, but what would some people are suggesting that during the summer, the center of the Arctic Ocean would be ice-free in September and October, and consequently with that, the season where easier shipping would take place would extend as well.
Yeah.
Okay, could I have the next slide, please?
You're there at the next slide.
Oh, okay. That's a rough chart of the very extensive petrochemical and mineral resources in the Arctic Ocean. Now, this some people talk of a race to Arctic resources. That needs a dose of realism. It's true that there are enormous deposits of oil, gas, minerals in the Arctic Ocean. However, they, for good reason, have not yet been exploited. It's dark, cold, dangerous, and very, very expensive. Nevertheless, there is, over the longer term, it is very promising in terms of being an attractive place to invest in order to get resources. This is the idea of a gold mine up in the of a treasure chest up in the Arctic that has provoked the analogies of being a great race towards the Arctic. But as I said, there's some constraints there that will persist for years. Can I have the next slide, please, the one called Arctic Boundaries Claims. That's just an illustration of the number of different legal claims that different countries have for different reasons over the Arctic Ocean. That's a very important issue because obviously the appearance in the slide before of new resources and uncertainties over boundaries is the sort of thing that has caused wars for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. For the moment, this is quite well under control through the United Nations Law of the Sea process and through the Committee for the Delimitation of the Continental Shelf between the various Arctic coastal states. There is an agreement between the Arctic coastal states to reach bilateral agreements where there are territorial disputes. For example, the Russians and the Norwegians reached a territorial agreement in the Barents Sea about 2 or 3 years ago, which everybody expected it would be impossible because of the traditional nationalism and belligerence of the Russians. But the process is quite promising in terms of a commitment by the Arctic states to the peaceful settlement and of individual boundary issues in the interests of broader cooperation. We still, of course, have a Canada-U.S. dispute over a triangle in the Beaufort off Alaska and the Yukon, which unfortunately has not yet been resolved. U.S. has a problem in that it has not yet ratified the Law of the Sea. We have a difference which I think we've managed well and could manage even better over the status of the waters through the Arctic archipelago, where we state that they are internal waters, and the United States, based on its global interests, would say that there should be freedom of navigation, of innocent passage through our territorial waters. Can I go on to the next slide, please?
Okay, we're there.
Okay. The interest, this issue of Arctic shipping routes is, for me, has been probably one of the most interesting parts of this. I was driven towards this issue largely because of a long-standing interest in the search for the Northwest Passage over 300 years, and also the relative lack of Canadian government attention to the development of the Northwest Passage. It's simply not a priority for Canada at the moment, though there has been shipping of one kind or another up there for centuries. Most of our commerce up there and maritime commerce is of a destinational character, which means individual ships coming in and out to service communities or bring fuel oil or bring construction materials or serve projects or bring out minerals. This Arctic shipping route is indicative. On the left, you can see the route through the Canadian Northwest Passage. In the middle, you find the central transpolar sea route, which is not yet open. It could be, if you have a big nuclear Russian icebreaker, you can go through there in the summer. And then on the right, you see what is the most dramatic development in the Arctic in response to these changes, which is the Russian Northern Sea Route. The real commercial leaders in the in the Arctic are the Russians. They work. They have invested hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, in fleets of nuclear icebreakers. They are developing offshore oil and gas facilities all along the coast of Siberia. They've created a Northern Sea Route administration in order to encourage paying traffic through the Northern Sea Route from Europe to Asia and back as a significant money saver and money maker for Russia, as it provides much shorter routes than going through the Panama Canal. A chart some of you will certainly have seen before is the next one, called Icebreakers of the World.
John, before you go on to that one, I'd like to interrupt and ask you. Now, you said the middle route, you'd need an icebreaker because there's still a lot of ice. The red, which is the Northern Sea Route, where we're seeing increase in activity, is the increase in activity because that's where there's the least amount of ice, or is it because Russia's been very active in getting set up to make it come that way? And how does the northern there in the red compare with the northwest passage in the green as far as the ice and getting through it and how much of the year it's open? I'm just wondering if it's being dictated by the less amount of ice or by Russia's active role.
I'd say it's a combination of the two. The geographically, I think the northern sea route, that is the Russian passage, is relatively more ice-free than the northwest passage at a given time in July or August or September. There's a tendency for some of the straits in the northwest passage to clog up because of movements of ice, because of the wind and tides moving ice. That's been less of a problem in recent years, but what the Russians have done is they have developed a system of icebreakers and convoys and ice pilots and permissions for sea shipment through the Northwest Passage. To give you just an example, we had one ship, just one, pure transpolar travel through the Northwest Passage last summer, a ship called the Nordic Orion, which picked up coal in Vancouver and brought it through the Northwest Passage without icebreaker assistance to a port in Finland. As I said, it's the exception that proves the rule. It was accompanied briefly by a Canadian icebreaker, but it was not necessary for it to provide assistance. But the contrast is on the other, on the Russian Northwest Passage, Northern Sea Route, where there were hundreds of ships all together going in and out for destinational reasons, for exporting oil, gas, minerals, and so forth, and probably between 25 and 60 transits, depending on how you define a transit, major ships going through the Northern Sea Route. And that number has been expanding quite dramatically in recent years. And this is not accidental, because President Putin has made the development of the Russian Arctic, the, quote, return to the Russian Arctic, a very major priority for Russia, attempting a kind of economic renaissance around a Northern Sea Route which serves both energy projects and transit traffic. And I think the Russians see this as one way of escaping the kind of chokehold that geography has placed on Russia in respect to its access to deepwater ports. It's quite an impressive development. It's broadly integrated, and it's also becoming increasingly integrated with Russian defense and security efforts as well. I don't think there's anything to worry about in that area. It's not done aggressively because Russia is desperately in need of capital, international capital, to develop its oil and gas reserves, for example, in the difficult areas of Siberia and along the Arctic coast, and doesn't want to frighten away international capital in that respect. But it's Canada and the United States. Canada is probably the least developed country in respect of Arctic maritime development, followed probably then by the United States. The Russians are far ahead in respect of, if you see that list of icebreakers there, that gives you an idea of the investment in state-owned equipment and infrastructure in order to promote economic development in the Arctic. Norway is, and the Scandinavians are, of course, very advanced in the Arctic area. Part of the reason being that even though it's far north, Norway is, of course, not icebound simply because of Atlantic currents. It's a very different situation, but they are probably the world leaders in Arctic oil and gas development because of, for historical reasons. They're also cooperating very dramatically with the Russians, and all of the Scandinavians and the Russians cooperate much more actively than, say, Canada and the U.S. cooperate through an agency called the Barents Council, which includes Russia, Norway, Finland, and Sweden. It's, to some extent, in my view, a model of what we should be doing to intensify Canada, Alaska cooperation up in the north. The next, do you want to take a look at the Northern Sea Route slide? That's the next one.
Yeah.
Yes.
That, all along that route, there are search and rescue stations. There are, it's a high level of mapping, a high level of control. Companies have to, and countries have to pay fees to go through the Russian Northern Sea Route. It's very closely regulated. Many shipping companies apply but are not granted the rights to go through. They're very strict on the type of ship that goes through in terms of ice hardening in relation to particular ice conditions, and they are closely monitored by both electronically and by Russia's massive fleet of large, very large, and medium-sized icebreakers. But that, to me, I know I was asked by speaking to a commercial group recently, I was asked, what did it matter, say, to container traffic and others? And I said, at the moment it doesn't. It's a tiny fraction of world trade. There are 18,000 transits every year of the Suez Canal. There's about, you know, as I said, between 30 and 60 through the Northern Sea Route last year. But it's starting from a very small base. But it's a sign of what of a very important trend. If the ice keeps melting, the nature of the ice keeps changing because the newer the ice, the easier it is to break, and the possibilities for global commerce coming through the Northern Sea Route. In my mind, it's a mistake for North America to essentially grant commercial monopoly to the Russians over the over transpolar travel, marine transport in the Arctic, and we should be thinking about and planning for joint development of the Northwest Passage.
John, Representative Higgins has a question.
Yeah, thanks, John. Is the Northern Sea Route, is that opened up almost year-round now, or are they still constricted to summertime use?
I'd say they are. It's probably 4 months now. Probably it can be extended somewhat depending on the use of icebreakers, but it's certainly not all year round. Certainly not. No.
Okay.
So we're seeing, in geologic time, we're seeing an enormously fast change in the Arctic. In our time scale, it's happening relatively slowly, i.e. over decades.
And then one follow-up real quick, John. In your, and this may be a hard question for you to answer, in your opinion, do you think that this, while the sea ice is still shrinking, do you think it'll ever recover and come back?
That's, to be perfectly honest, that's possible. Of course it's possible. You know, is this a trend that's going to go on for the next 100 years? Or is this a cycle where it stabilizes? We just don't know. We just have the evidence of the last 30 or 40 years that this seems to be a steady trend. Those who attribute everything to human conditions and global warming would say everything is going to get worse and worse, and the Arctic is going to melt, and that's just one more sign of the effect of global warming. There are many other models that try to explain global warming in terms of cycles of the sun, wobbles in the Earth's orbit, unexplicable changes in broad climate patterns, and I just don't know. I just know what we all see in front of us in over the last 30 years, and we should certainly can't place our bets on the fact that it's going to suddenly reverse.
Thank you, John. Just so I get this right, did you say there were 18,000 vessels going through Suez, and right now we're at 30 to 60 with no added zeros through the northern routes? Did I get that right?
That's correct.
And
correct. Yep.
And do you have the number for the Panama Canal, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, it's a little bit smaller. Actually, I was just in Panama. So there's about 10,000 transits a year.
Okay. And can you tell us how many miles or kilometers the northern sea route shaves off? I remember hearing it was pretty impressive, but I don't recall what it was compared to, and I don't know which canal it was comparing to, but do you have that information?
I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I know it's probably about a week of sailing, so it's definitely a significant amount, a significant saving, particularly for ships that come from Japan or Korea, who have a long way to go through Suez, because they've got to go way south down to around Malaysia to get back up through the Indian Ocean to Suez, to then around Europe to say Northern Europe.
So it can shave off about a week of time. All right, we need to keep moving along here. Wrap up here.
Right. Okay. I'm the next slide shows Canada's northern strategy. It's a fairly simplistic document compared with the very detailed documents that have been coming spewing forth from Washington in the last 6 months. We have a unique concern that you'd probably need a psychologist to explain over Canadian views on sovereignty. We're obviously concerned about economic and social development, a lot of attention to the environment, And governance is, in a way, what something that has occupied Canadians more than economic development in our Arctic has been the devolution of powers to the Northern Territories, which have massive amounts of land, but very small populations. And this is the devolution of federal powers. The Yukon has the most, the highest level of devolution, not far below what a Canadian province has. There's recently been agreements between the federal government and the Northwest Territories over certain jurisdictions like control over natural resources, something that I'm sure Alaska would like. And the least developed area is Nunavut, which is the large area largely populated by Inuits that comprises most of the Arctic archipelago. It has both a Westminster-style territorial government and a quasi-government formed entirely by Inuits who own large amounts of land, promising land there as a result of land claims agreement. But even that, when that is being said, all three territories are still largely dependent on federal largesse in order to fund their education and school education and health systems. So they're far from independent. And my own view is that the Canadian government probably has not taken up its full responsibilities for national development in the Arctic, providing the same kind of infrastructure for national reasons in the north as we've provided so effectively in the south. I mentioned, then the next slide is the Arctic Council priorities. Canada is the chair of the Arctic Council now, which is one of the organizations that I think exercises a positive influence over development in the Arctic, over peaceful development and cooperation in the Arctic. We have an Inuit lady, Ms. Glukak, who is a minister who is now our chair of the Arctic Council, and it has some promising and somewhat controversial priorities in its emphasis on resource development for the sake of Northerners, to meet the interests of Northerners, safe Arctic shipping. It's a slight deviation from previous Canadian and Arctic Council priorities, which used to emphasize more the environment, science, stewardship, and sustainability. The vocabulary has shifted somewhat. I'd say in action there's not as yet much sign that those priorities have been turned into action nationally or internationally, but that's an important part of Canada. Could I see the next slide, please?
Mm-hmm.
This shows a picture of current marine transportation systems and projects in Canada. As you can see, a lot of traffic comes up from Montreal up to around Baffin Island to serve the 30-odd small communities up in the Arctic, in Nunavut. We have an Arctic port in Churchill, something that was built in the 1930s on Hudson's Bay, but never really developed seriously. We have an interesting route that does exist from a railhead on Great Slave Lake out of Alberta all the way down the Mackenzie River in terms of barging and supporting communities. There's obviously Yukon has a road access to good road access to British Columbia and to Yukon. There's also the Port of Skagway, which is interesting, not yet probably exploited as well as it should be. But as you can see, that's been the historic pattern of the last 15 or 20 years. on balance, the Canadian Arctic is in acute need of greater attention to small and large ports, aids to navigation, charting for greater safety, better communications, and some positive things are happening in that respect. There's a movement to develop a framework of policy framework for marine corridors by our Coast Guard and Transport Canada, something that was discussed and raised at a roundtable that we held in Ottawa about 2 years ago with Frank Murkowski and Mead Treadwell and a number of prominent Canadians being active. So there are beginnings to be signs of life that the government of Canada is going to put its shoulder to the wheel on some of these critical areas of maritime development in the north in order to support projects, support communities, and so forth.
John, Representative Pruitt has joined us, and if you could wrap up here in the next couple of minutes, please.
Yeah, I'm there. The next slide is the Nordic Orion's historic transit of the Northwest Passage. This was unexpected by all the experts, but it demonstrated that a large ice-capable bulk carrier can economically use the Northwest Passage at a certain period of the year. And that's quite significant. They made money on that trip. They could carry a heavier load than if they'd gone through the Northwest, through the Panama Canal, which would have taken them much more fuel and much longer. Finally, the final slide is one that I have made up and has no status whatsoever, which is the North American Arctic Marine Highway. I spent years in Washington, and I have a lot of experience on Canada-U.S. relations and what we've achieved over the last, since World War II in respect of cooperation, whether it's NORAD or the St. Lawrence Seaway or the International Joint Commission or the FTA and NAFTA, or the Beyond the Borders activities, which have gone on since 9/11. And to me, that is the kind of high-level vision and dialogue that we need to develop marine corridors and high-level Arctic cooperation between Canada and the United States. That at the moment, that is not really happening. Okay, that's it.
Well, thank you very much. Do we have any comment or question from any members of the committee?
Sure.
Representative Herron.
John, good to hear your voice. Of course, I had several questions, but I'll just cut to the chase here. What do you think the United States should concentrate on our chairmanship that begins May of 2015?
I believe that there should be. The problem with the Arctic Council is that it tries to do everything, and it still is stuck, in my view, in a vocabulary of scientific research, environment, stewardship, all of which I support strongly. But to me, marine transportation and the development of closer cooperation among the coastal Arctic states is very important in respect of looking at these opportunities that are appearing in respect of marine transport in the Arctic. I approve of the working groups, but I would look carefully at how the working groups are constituted. I'd look at, particularly in the Canadian and U.S. situations, on how regional governments are represented, because, I mean, our three territories in Alaska should have a distinctive voice in the Arctic Council. It should not just be through federal authorities. You wouldn't have no trouble with the Norwegians on that. The Russians, of course, have a great number of small areas, but I don't think they can legitimately be called independent. So as a, I think in some respects we're going to have to work around the Arctic Council rather than through it, simply by emphasizing bilateral relations like Canada and the U.S. I noticed a striking lack of references to Canada in the President's recent implementation plan for the national strategy for the Arctic region, no reference to NORAD, for example, and closer kind of triangular cooperation between Canada, Russia, and the United States. That really is the core of the Arctic region in respect of exchanging data and cooperation on marine issues, energy issues, search and rescue, and so forth. So I'm afraid the Arctic Council risks becoming a bit of a talk shop.
Madam Chair, John, I appreciate the your comments. Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, I'll send John an email with the other seven questions and ask him, put them in writing, and send it to you, and then you can distribute it to the other members.
Yes, thank you. That would be great. Appreciate that. And John, we really appreciate your joining us. At some point, I look forward to meeting you in person. And I thank you for your work in this area and for working with us here in Alaska. And I agree with you that we don't want to be in a position where we're giving Russia the monopoly. And it's something that we need to put in the forefront and work more proactively. So with that, thank you very much. And next, I see our next presenter is ready, and I believe I failed to mention this at the beginning. We had a second presentation. I apologize for that, but Paul is here. And Paul, I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name.
Fuz.
Paul Fuz and Ed Page with Marine Exchange of Alaska, and they're here to continue this discussion. And so, and yes, we did hear a cell phone ring, and so the next meeting we would like donuts and cookies, perhaps.
If it's any consolation, it was my wife. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you can thank her for the donuts and cookies for us then. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Paul Fuse. I'm president of the Board of Directors of the Marine Exchange, and we're an Alaska nonprofit that has set up a vessel tracking and emergency response system. And I've also been working on the Northern Sea Route for about 20 years since I was mayor of Dutch Harbor. So one thing of the people that I've been around this quite a bit, it's accelerated in the past few years. A lot of discussion's been about global warming and how this is going to help change things, and it has accelerated things some, but everyone agrees that regardless of what happens with global warming, that the Arctic is open. We're not going to close it again. And what happens when humans move into an area, they don't leave. And no more dramatic example of that than our own Inuit people of the North Slope, who arrived about 10,000 years ago in one of the harshest climates anybody could imagine, and survived and thrived developing their own technology. Well, you've seen this slide, the shipping routes, and as Mr. Higginbottom mentioned, it's been destinational shipping of Russia. They've occupied their space. But lately we've seen more transpolar shipping and things like that. But another thing with the ice is that it moves around. Even though there's less ice, the last 2 years have actually been worse for shipping because the ice stacked up around Zemelya Island here in Russia. So that ice moves around. Just because there's less of it doesn't mean that it still isn't a challenge. So this is a track of the vessel traffic in the Northern Sea Route in the year 2013. Actually, about 400 vessels went through. 71 of those actually were in transpolar shipment across the Northern Sea Route. And as Mr. Higginbotham mentioned, about 17,000 through the Suez, 14,000 through the Panama Canal. But It's been increasing by about 50% a year, and the Russians and some of the Chinese feel that by the year 2030 we'll have about 2,000 vessels a year. So not as big as the biggest territories, but still a substantial amount of cargo. Well, how do we know this? Well, we set up all these stations around the Arctic to receive the AIS signals that are put out by vessels over a certain size are required to indicate their destination. And we can see them. They transmit about every 6 seconds, and we're accurate to about 3 meters, which is about 10 feet. So we know exactly where these ships are. And we also record who owns them, the vessel name, what they're carrying, what type of cargo, what type of fuel, and all of that information is also available to us. Well, what really changes things here is if we look at potential container traffic, and almost all the shipping in the Northern Sea Route so far has been bulk shipping of ores and petroleum products and things like this, but we're right on the Great Circle Route here between Asia and the United States, and a huge amount of traffic is going this way carrying containers. I call this Marco Polo in the 21st century because the potential exists for linking those two with dedicated icebreakers on the Northern Sea Route, hooking up with those container ships that are already going between Asia and the U.S. and having a transshipment hub at either Adak or Dutch Harbor. This would really change and accelerate the amount of cargo. Well, this is a slide here. This is just one day. This is January 22nd. This is about 1 month ago. This is the normal traffic that's traveling on the Great Circle Route, and you can see that that's a huge amount of traffic. Right now it's about 80% of capacity for containers, so there is capacity to carry additional container cargo.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Perrin.
Paul, of course that's today, but if Kitimat or Prince Rupert opens it up and Canadians are moving their resources trans-Pacific, isn't that number going to 3,600 now annually going through UNIMAC Pass in our waters, it may double within 10, 15 years.
Yes, sir, that's correct. And in addition, there's concern over the type of cargo because that's going to be crude oil. So we're going to see a lot more crude oil tankers going, which, you know, it increases our concern for incidents in that area. And the draft is out of the Aleutians Island Risk Assessment. You know, I don't have a copy of it yet, but it is out for discussion, and they go through a lot of this too, and we probably need to do a similar assessment of the Bering Strait in terms of that, and hopefully it's a little more streamlined than the Aleutians Islands, which took about 5 years to do. Okay, so now this is the, you see the combination of the two routes. This is a good slide because it visually shows you the difference in the shipping routes between the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal. And from the U.S. West Coast, it saves about 10 days off the Panama Canal, and from Asia, it saves about 20 days off the Suez Canal. So it's a substantial difference in time. Of course, you do need an icebreaker, and you know you're going to want that even if there's less ice. But there's a cost to that. But the difference is that the cost of a Russian icebreaker is just about equal to, actually it's a little bit less than the anti-piracy insurance for going around the Cape Horn and going by the coast of Africa. But when you get down to vessel costs for transportation, the Northern Sea Route is no more expensive from an administrative point of view, even though you have to hire an icebreaker all the way through because of piracy issues.
Just for clarification, so that would be for the operational, but we're not talking about the vessel itself. The vessel, the icebreaker vessels are much more expensive themselves, correct? So you're talking about to operate it?
What I'm saying is that if you sail your own ship, it's going to cost you fuel to go both ways. Well, if I go by Africa, it's going to cost me, in addition, piracy insurance. Mm-hmm. I go the Northern Sea Route, in addition, I have to pay icebreaker fees. It's no more expensive to pay for the icebreaker than it is to pay for the anti-piracy insurance. So you can save all the fuel cost savings of 10 or 20 days of sailing. Everyone thinks, well, geez, you got to pay for an icebreaker. Yeah, but you go the other way, you got to pay anti-piracy insurance. So that's the equalizer for that cost. Mm-hmm. Now, this changes everything. This is a South Korean design for an actual ice-breaking container ship. It is powered by LNG. It's actually a multi-fuel vessel. And this would be a dedicated vessel run on the Northern Sea Route that would connect to the other ships on the Great Circle Route. There will be LNG available. Black carbon is one of the issues that's being raised more and more in the Arctic, and this would actually avoid any of those issues being an LNG-powered vessel. So now
excuse
we get
me,
down to
that,
the ice.
Excuse me, is that just in design, or is there, do those exist?
This is just in design right now. This vessel does not exist yet. So now we'll get down to what does exist, and on this chart is the different icebreakers of Russia, and the shaft power of 25 megawatts. Those vessels do exist today, but they have ordered five of these larger vessels of 60 megawatt. One is being built right now, and another is on the block. So although it kind of garbled the dates, by 2020 on the left, we'll have three of the 60 megawatt icebreakers, and by 2030, we'll have an additional two. For comparison, these are nuclear ships, nuclear over electric drive, so 60 megawatts of power. If we take the Bradley Lake Dam that supplies a huge portion of Anchorage's electricity, it's a 45 megawatt dam. But this is half again the Bradley Lake Dam, the power of one ship. So what that does to the shipping, right now this is a window, shipping windows, and when you see the number of sailing days for existing vessel, it's about 150 days. We're at about 5 months we can use the Northern Sea Route. For the new 60 megawatt vessels that you see above, they'll be able to operate 7 months out of the year. And then you see another chart above that says 110 to 130 megawatts. And that's this vessel. Now, this has not been constructed. This is a 110-megawatt Russian icebreaker, and this ship will be able to operate year-round. It can operate, it can do 12 knots through 3.5 meters of ice continuously. It's 10 feet of ice. This ship has not been built yet, but this changes everything right here.
Representative Pruitt.
Can you give me how big are we talking on the last three pages? How big are these icebreakers? Are these the icebreakers that are going in front of the cargo ships? Are they intended to hold the cargo?
Yes, sir, through the chair. They do not hold cargo. They are the ships that break the ice in front, and they're there if the ship gets in trouble and the other ship's convoy behind them.
Okay, so almost like a an ice or an Arctic tugboat, essentially.
That's correct.
Okay, great.
That's correct. Well, with this vessel here, 93 meters, it's about 600 feet long. That's a pretty big ship, about 100 feet wide, but still 11 to 13 meters draft. And one thing that this points out for all of these vessels, you need about 35 foot of depth for a port to accommodate them. And that's why for the Arctic port studies that have gone through, we're looking at 35 feet as the depth. That would also accommodate the Coast Guard vessels that we have. That's the design depth that you need for an Arctic port to be able to accommodate these vessels. And you've got two potentials for that. One is Nome and one at Port Clarence. When you get further north, we're so shallow so far out, it's probably unrealistic that we're going to get to minus 35 further north. Now this, actually two of these vessels exist. This is a for the Yamal oil and gas development, and this is a South Korean design and built vessel. It's about 900 feet long. It's almost as long as some of our biggest container ships. And for 7 months out of the year, now it goes around through the Suez Canal to Asia, and for 5 months a year they're coming through the Northern Sea Route. For total development of this field, 16 of these vessels. So they've got two now, 14 more are being built in Korean shipyards. And, of course, other people internationally are becoming more interested. Here's the Chinese icebreaker that we saw coming through, and we picked up their track. You can see their track in U.S. waters. And part of this is because we have not exercised our sovereignty through the Law of the Sea Treaty. This is wide open for everybody to come up. So I know we've passed several resolutions on that, and hopefully we can get to the 67 votes we need to pass that. As a result, result, everybody's watching more and more. We see people, you know, what's going on with the Northern Sea Route, what's going to happen, and there's potential opportunity, but there's also risk. In terms of the risk, well, here's a crude oil tanker that came through the Bering Straits. And of the total cargo last year through the Bering Straits, about 1.3 million tons, 800,000 of those tons were petroleum products. About two-thirds of the cargo is petroleum products. And the concern there is that we are really unprepared for any type of an incident that should happen in that area. One of the biggest areas of concern, this shows you the circulation patterns in the Arctic. And when you look at this, all the patterns show that if we have an incident in Bering Strait, that is going to come straight to the west coast of Alaska, all along our coast. So we really don't have the response capability there now. We need to get it. We need those Arctic ports. For the Russians, oh, and this is a little bit too small to see. I'm going to get you a bigger version of this. You might want to put up in the room here. These are all the Arctic oil developments, and, you know, all through the Barents Sea, completely full of oil development. Russia, the Canadian side, Iceland, Greenland, all have leased. And, you know, the frustrating thing for me is we see our own offshore oil development shut down through lawsuits and everything else, is if in the end they're successful in stopping development in U.S. waters, it's not going to stop oil development in the Arctic. It just means that we're going to have 0% of the opportunity and almost 100% of the risk. These are Russian response centers, and the previous presenter talked about this, but we're not really sure what's there. And this is something we're working on with the Coast Guard. Providinia and Nadir, they're shown as circles on the map, but what really is there for response capabilities? And we do have some agreements with the Russians on joint response, but we really think that this needs to be drilled and exercised and to see really what is there, both in terms of preventing an incident and responding to one should it occur. And again, Nome and Port Clarence, we absolutely have to have something there. And, you know, the numbers are fairly high for developing those. We're going to need some federal assistance. As we talk to the Coast Guard and even the Department of Defense have weighed in now, but there hasn't been any concrete action behind it. And we need to get beyond feelings that, you know, we really want to be an Arctic nation and really start to act like one by putting in, making some of the investments. Are we going to be spectators or actors? Are we going to ride the wave or be rolled over by it? And, of course, in everything we do, we have to do it right. And we have to do it right the first time, and we have to do it right every time. It's a high-risk area. It is going to be open. We have to be sure that we play our part and occupy our space in having the facilities to accommodate this. Will it lead to a brighter future? That's really up to us and what we do. And before I close here, I just want to, you know, thank Representative Heron for his leadership over a long time on these issues and for this committee's interest in it. And I think some of this is going to tie into the bill that you and Senator McGuire have put in on Arctic infrastructure development. It's really important that hopefully that bill can make it through this session and give us some tools to finance some of these. But the federal government's also going to have to come to the table.
Thank you, Paul, very much. And just to go back, you talked about two-thirds of what's being hauled are petroleum products. And then when you showed us, I don't remember what slide it was, but because of currents and things, that wherever, if a spill were to occur, it would end up on our shores? Is
correct.
That what?
Yeah,
and is that because of currents and weather?
Weather currents, the Arctic circulation patterns, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and even coming over from the Russian side, you see that this comes, everything heads this way, all the circulation patterns.
Madam Chair, on that point is, yes, is the Bering Strait is this sieve, and when you push water through a sieve, it increases, and so the warm is going north and the cold is going south, and so you have this tremendous pressure sieve that is, yes, if anything happens in above the strait, it's going to come to us. But at the same time, anything below the strait happens, it's going to come to us. Mm-hmm. We're the victim here by the geography.
And I guess as follow-up to either one of you, since Russia seems to be miles ahead of us and all the activity they're involved with, are they taking any liability or doing anything to protect against that?
And I just came back from an international conference in Norway on this, and they had some insurance people there, and they asked them what would be the chain of liability in this, and the guy said, well, we really don't have an answer for that. So it's something that really needs to be paid attention to. We need to work closer with the Russians, but on an international level, we're fighting over Syria and everything else, so, you know, it's difficult to do those. So, you know, we're hoping on a local level with our Coast Guard and everybody that we can get those agreements to work. I mean, you know, they have the same concerns we do. In Norway, they did resolve a dispute, and what came out of that, when we talked to the Norwegians, that's how they were able to put in the safety of marine shipping agreements, that they've got fairways, you're staying further offshore when you're shipping to give more time in case you have an incident, establish fairways, vessel tracking, all of those they were able to. The Barents Sea Agreement is a great model for us to look at in terms of an international agreement in our area. So I think we should move forward with that as well.
What do you think is the best venue for working toward that agreement? Through the Arctic Council? Or?
Well, we're in the Arctic Council right now, and it's interesting that as some of the meetings that I've observed there, the Russians do seem more interested in nailing down real criteria and policies on this, solid, more than the rest, and part of it is a bit of a tension with our own State Department and Department of Defense. We have been the number one defenders worldwide of innocent passage, because we don't want any restrictions on our vessel in the Straits of Hormuz or wherever else in the world it is. So with that, we have very little ability to regulate any of these vessels in international trade, whether through Unimak Pass or through the Bering Strait. And it's our own State Department and Department of Defense that are taking that line. Well, our position is it's fine if you want to take that, then you need to protect your own coastline. You need to do something to have the assets there. You need the icebreakers. We need a deep water Arctic port. We need cleanup facilities. You know, we need to have some capacity. We can't carry that all on our own. So if that's a national policy we're going to have, there's other conclusions that come from that our federal government needs to step forward with. And, you know, our congressional delegation has been great in proposing this, but it's really hard for them to get the traction on this. And I know Representative Herron's been involved in a lot of these, and, you know, you get down to where, you know, everyone's talking a good game, but where's the beef?
Mm-hmm.
Right? We've got to get beyond feelings.
Representative Herron, do you have any comments?
Well,
my question?
It's the Barents Regional Business Forum Council that they have is a good model. And, of course, Arctic Caucus in Penwar is pursuing that with our Canadian officials. And so this is actually, this committee is a good one to, it has to be grassroots. We don't want it to come from D.C. down on us. We want to bring it to D.C. And we need to reach out to our Canadian neighbors and our Russian neighbors about having these sub-region or sub-national agreements. And that's what John Higginbotham would say, is that's the way you get the attention of the national governments, is if the sub-nationals have worked out these regional projects. And then Beaufort Regional Business Council is getting a little bit of traction, because you want the multinationals to be talking to each other with the three subnational jurisdictions, Northwest Territories, Yukon, and Alaska, because the Beauforts are common denominator. And for all the reasons that Paul has outlined, lots of risks, but at the moment, very little opportunity. So, yes, the conversation has to come from the subnationals.
Okay, thank you.
If I could just follow up on that real quick. So we went to Canada, and we went to their national government and said, okay, we'll pay for it. Let's go in. We'll put a couple receiving stations in your villages there so that we can see what's coming to us. We want advance notice of what's coming to us. We'll tell you what's coming to you. We went round and round with their Coast Guard and Foreign Service and everything like that, and the answer came back as well. We think you're probably going to have to wait until we elect a new prime minister. Mm. And it just seemed like such a no-brainer, you know, that we'd want to know. I mean, this is maritime domain awareness. So, you know, when you get on the international side, there could be things completely unrelated to the actual things that we're talking about here. And that one of the potential hammers of this thing may be straight commercial. If we can make a strong enough case that and it may be the insurance companies that actually come in and say, you're going to have those protections or I'm not going to let you operate there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pruitt, did you have something?
Quick statement and then a question. The statement is, of course, with the Obama administration indicating that we have a potentially have an ambassador, I think the committee should come up with a resolution designating Bob Heron as that ambassador. just saying.
Above my pay grade.
Actually, if you don't mind, I'm just kind of in the same vein, but I want to shift gears just a little bit. A lot of conversation here related to Russia, of course, because of their connection. But there's another element there, of course, China wanting to be an aspect of their shipping, Arctic oil and gas development, et cetera. But of course, they're also about to invest a substantial amount of money into Nicaragua and the canal through Nicaragua. Some of the discussion we've had here, you know, the estimates on numbers that we see going through the Northwest Passage, mm-hmm. et cetera, how does that potentially change based on the canal going into Nicaragua? Do we still expect to see the considerable additional traffic moving through? What impact? I don't know what the impact has on you know, miles. To reference one of Mr. Higginbotham's slides, he had the distance between, of course, Seattle and New Jersey, mm-hmm. the difference. How do you see that impacting the Arctic shipping lanes, the fact that there'll be another avenue that opens up? And I would foresee also that, of course, being that China's investing in it, that some of the potential traffic, I would expect they would steer that direction for their own national security. Any discussion or any thoughts on that?
I met with the Chinese delegates at this Northern Sea Route Conference in Tromsø, Norway, and they're very aggressive on the Northern Sea Route, even regardless of the Panama Canal. What it does is it allows larger vessels to go through. That's the main restriction now is the vessel size.
Right.
But they don't expect the charges to be any less. And what you've got is individual companies and sectors. And some of them, it means more to them to be able to ship quicker. So it depends upon the product. You know, if it's iron ore, you probably don't care if it gets there a week late. You know, if it's some perishable product, you need to move it to market right now. So they're actually more aggressive than the Japanese, even though there's less time savings for them, as it seemed to me. And they had done quite a bit of economic analysis on it and saw a substantial amount of cargo going from China to Europe.
Interesting. And just clarification, that makes the, of course, they're looking to invest in Nicaragua. It's not even just the expansion of Panama. Of course, their own investment, several many billions of dollars there. So interesting. They're going to try to go above and below us here.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, when you look at that slide, you see the difference. That's a lot of distance to make up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, even with another thing through Nicaragua. I mean, it just, you know, it's just like mileage on your car. You're going to burn that fuel.
Right.
That's really what it is. So $100 a barrel of oil, you know, it's going to cost you.
Thanks.
Is there anything else? Any other? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I missed this, but just while we're talking about this, because of the cost overruns on that project, does that have any impact on the attractiveness of the route relative to others, you know, in terms of what that'll mean for total cost?
The expansion of the Panama Canal is about $1.6 billion cost overrun right now, and they're actually in a hiatus of building until they kind of figure that out. But even if they get that figured out, they're going to have to build that into the economic model, so it's not going to be cheap.
Right.
But you can put a bigger ship through it. Okay. That's the main advantage. It's not going to be any cheaper.
Okay. And, of course, they're going to have to compete with Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Yes, and I'll just say when I Googled Nicaragua Canal, the first few postings had to do with it wrecking the environment. So we'll see how that moves forward.
If you own the government, you can do a lot of things.
It's a little slightly different situation. Well, you have any closing comments, Paul?
No, just that, you know, we're going to stay on this, and at least we have the diagnostic tools to tell you exactly what's going on and what ships are there, and, you know, we'll continue doing that. We have set up, because of federal regulations requiring non-tank vessels within 50 miles of shore, we've set up an additional emergency and oil spill response capability. Mm-hmm. And this was just really, as of 2 weeks ago, it got initiated. So that gives us an additional 1,000 vessels on this Great Circle route and through Alaska to put into oil spill and response capability here. We still miss about half the vessels in Innocent Passage on the Great Circle route. But, you know, we're looking at that and combining with some of the other oil spill response organizations, because our 30,000 miles of coastline, we're spread so thin. We have to combine all of our capabilities, and, you know, but there are some policy issues with that. So let's say I'm Alaska Clean Seas, I'm supposed to take care of Shell, and I get a tugboat there. Well, now I got a big cargo tanker at St. Lawrence Island 6 hours away. It's lost power. It's drifting toward shore. Well, this special vessel could rescue it. Mm-hmm. Will they be released to go rescue that vessel? And then would Shell have to shut down? Or is there going to be some agreement that within certain limitations, you're still meeting the requirements of your contingency plan? Mm-hmm. But you're obviously an asset. We've got an emergency, and we need to respond. So some of those things really need to be worked out. You know, we've got several overlapping jurisdictions now of oil spill response. Some are state requirements, some are tanker, some are non-tanker, and I think we've got the opportunity now to really coordinate that together and get the best response that we can. And all the vessels do pay for this. They pay a fee into it to have this this coverage, but the vessels in Innocent Passage do not.
Okay, well, thank you for your work and for your organization and for what you shared with us. I think we all learned something, at least I know I did, and so I appreciate you coming today. And before we adjourn, I'll just mention that Tuesday we will be learning about the statewide link to economic certainty, the Point McKenzie Enterprise Zone, and then Thursday we will the meeting will be canceled. So just one meeting next week on Tuesday. So with that, if there's nothing else, we will adjourn at 12:34. Thank you.